You're listening to In Motion, a Masters of the Stage podcast. In Motion is a series of interviews dedicated to the voices of America's leading stage choreographers.
Hello, this is Wendy Seib, and you are In Motion. I'm here with the amazing choreographer, Bill T. Jones. To give you a little bit of his background, he is the artistic director, co-founder of Bill T. Jones and Arnie Zane Company, and founding artistic director of New York Live Arts. He is a recipient of the 2014 Doris Duke Award, the 2013 Presidential Medal of the Arts, and the 2010 Kennedy Center Award Honors. He won Tony Awards for Best Choreography for both Fela and Spring Awakening, an Obie Award and Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation Callaway Award for his choreography in Spring Awakening, and the 2006 Lucille Lortel Award for Outstanding Choreography for Seven. He has also won the 2010 Jacob's Pillow Dance Award and the 2007 USA Eileen Harris Norton Fellowship, the 2005 Wexner Prize, the 2005 Samuel H. Scripps American Dance Festival Award for Lifetime Achievement, the 2005 Harlem Renaissance Award, the 2003 Dorothy and Lillian Gish Prize, and the 1994 MacArthur Genius Award. The Dance Heritage Coalition named Mr. Jones an irreplaceable dance treasure. So in addition to creating more than 140 works for his own company, Mr. Jones has received many commissions to create dances for top modern and ballet companies all over the world. He has received 8 honorary doctorates, including from Yale and Juilliard. He's been featured in numerous television, radio, film, and documentary programs, and many books have been written about his work. He is also a published author himself.
That's what I say.
Isn't that amazing?
Thank you for that. Thank you.
And now we're done with the interview. So please go to newyorklivearts.org in order to get more information about Bill and the wonderful work he's doing down at New York Live Arts, which I was so delighted to see that you are a part of and started. So
yes.
Thank you
yes,
for that.
Yes. New York Live Arts, in a way, is about homecoming. In the sense that I did my first works at what used to be called Dance Theater Workshop. And it was about 7-8 years ago that they were making changes and they were looking for a partner. And we were looking for a home, we being Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane Company. So that merger has resulted in a place that I am being forced to be an adult, in which, yes, most artists, not that we're all infantilized, but we are thinking about our work primarily. And yes, my company's work, we are the resident company there. However, I have to support the work of the field. And the field is very much in need of incubation space. And the field also wants to find a way out of its financial problems. And with that comes the idea, how can we build a bridge to the commercial theater with the progressive, what do you want to call it, body-based artist working at New York Live Arts. So I'm trying, my experience in the commercial theater is informing the direction in which we're trying to take that organization.
Good. Mm-hmm. That's always been a interest of mine also, coming from the modern ballet world.
And yes.
How do we grow that world? How do we move the dance world out of the small sort of world it is in, which mm-hmm. is lovely, mm-hmm. but we need to bring it to the larger world.
Not everyone agrees with us, because I agree that that's important. They believe that sometimes art is, in a way, self-selecting for its audience, and that's maybe when it's most vital. But I have this feeling that maybe it's being an African-American from the mid-20th century, born in 1952, a large family, looking for a people's theater, diverse, broad, and it is hard to find in the enclaves of those specialized areas of the art world. Now, Broadway has its own issues around diversity, and it is very expensive now, hasn't it? But we're all working on this. The audiences are there, and I find that people that come to commercial theater, and I have to break myself to saying Broadway, because we're not only talking Broadway,
right.
art, we're talking nationwide, maybe.
Right.
People are open. They go with the idea they want an adventure.
Yes.
They want something exciting. And you have them, at least for a while. So how can you satisfy all their needs?
And grow that.
And grow
that.
Grow
that interest and that community.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we need to hamper down the other specialized kind of work.
No, not at all.
There can be room for both.
Mm-hmm.
And also they can feed each other. And, yeah.
Well, how they feed each other, it is really something that we're working at. I was so gratified to see a work like Oklahoma, which was actually came from the theater department at Bard College, right? Mm-hmm. And then through a lot of smarts and passion, it's now in the Great White Way. How did that happen? It's an inspiration to a lot of other choreographers,
absolutely.
Myself included.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's good to see there's a nice shift happening, a little shake-up, I think, in a mm-hmm. lot of the art worlds, mainly the live arts.
Well, they say, is that because the audiences are younger now? Is that what it is?
I think so, and I also do think because they're younger and there is social media, I mean, there's so much dance on the internet
mm-hmm.
of varying degrees that I'm surprised myself, being in my mid-40s.
Mm. You're a baby.
I'm a baby.
Yes.
It's so much accessible, and with things like So You Think You Can Dance and Dancing with the Stars mm-hmm. and all the musicals, I think I'll speak for dance, there's so much more to find, to reach. You can find mm-hmm. it very easily. So I think that's sort of giving a lot to the younger generation.
And I appreciate that, but one of my concerns has been, for years we've been saying, dance is a be-there medium. It's real time, real space, real persons who might literally drop dead on stage, sweating, what have you, real force, as opposed to something that can be edited or can be mediated through camera angles and so on. So I still have a special place for live dance performance, although I agree with you, social media has expanded the potential of that.
Right. And I'd like to think that social media connection then gets that younger audience curious.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of dance I've seen is filmed in separate locations and not just the stage.
Yes.
And people have come to me and been like, oh my God, do you know this dancer? I'm like,
yeah.
I know who they are. You should go see them in this piece.
Right, wonderful.
So I'm kind of hoping it sort of becomes a cyclical thing mm-hmm. and then it feeds mm-hmm. one another and that. We shall see.
We shall see.
We put this down on a podcast and we'll know in 20 years.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yes.
Well, we had just spoken a little bit beforehand about your ideas of the Broadway choreographer, the modern choreographer, and all that. Mm-hmm. I would love to delve mm-hmm. into that.
Well, if you will indulge me, I was saying that when I came out of the university in the 70s, and was very, as like many, many young people are, very, very doctrinaire in a way, very high-minded about where is the pure movement. I sometimes tell the story of being an athlete until one day I went to a dance class, which was actually West African dance, and for the first time, I tasted sweat that was not competitive sweat, and it was the sweat of the studio, and I was hooked. I'm sure my colleagues out there are laughing behind their hand. Oh yeah, non-competitive, sure, yeah. But it's a different kind of competition.
It's very different.
That being said, the world really opened up. At that time, there was what I knew to be Martha Graham, there was the Alvin Ailey Company, and then there was Mount Olympus, New York City Ballet, ABT. I was never going to get there, starting to dance at age 18, 19, and with an athlete's body, no flexibility in the foot and all, and a very expressionistic bent. I was thinking, is this the way to be in the world as a human being? The freedom offered by dance. You realize we are talking dance at this point. Just a young man who wanted to be fabulous. Choreography came later.
Mm-hmm.
The appreciation that there was a whole culture, a whole land, if you will, of people who thought in movement, and that one had to, in a way, earn one's way into it, not just as the fabulousness of being a wonderful dancer, but how do you think about space and time? So modern dance seemed to me at that point to be the most unexplored area. And I thought the gates of Mount Olympus, I would call it, the ballet world, were closed to me. And people would say to me at that time, you should go and let Mr. Ailey finish you. That was the kind of solution to all young black dancers, go to Mr. Ailey. There was a rebelliousness. I was very respectful of him, and Alvin was a friend. He was on my board, but I never saw myself in his image. So modern dance versus ballet was the very first thing.
Mm-hmm.
And modern dance at the beginning was Martha Graham, Jose Limon, Doris Humphrey. Then there was this thing called the avant-garde in modern dance. The avant-garde that was saying, no, we do not have to have pointed feet. Mm-hmm. No, we don't even have to be emotionally communicative. Now, this is a big one for people who love theater. Sure. They were saying dance could be like any other art form. It could be about ideas. It could be about something as simple and elemental as space. And it could be abstract. Yes, Mr. Balanchine had made abstract ballets, but they were somehow housed in the narrative of Western theatrical dance. Modern dance was sometimes people who had been doctors, lawyers, people who wanted to be veterinarians, people who had other ways of defining themselves. And then they went to dance and got caught in this, in its porous potential. Where did this Broadway thing come? Well, I had been a student of at the university, at the University of New York at Binghamton, and I had actually thought at that time that I was going to become a Broadway performer. I didn't really make a distinction. I didn't see a lot of Broadway. We were very far away from it, but what I saw was the movies, Gene Kelly, Sammy Davis Jr., all that sort of thing. And it was something that had to be sacrificed, I thought, to make the pure art of modern dance. At least that's what I was being told. Mm-hmm. Your work should not be for sale. It should not be about seduction. It should not be all the things that we love in the theater, actually. Tell me a story.
Right.
I want to feel something. Take me on a journey, and you better bring me home. Because if you don't bring me home, if you leave me out in the existential land of questions, somehow that's a failed work. I don't know if we still feel that way on Broadway, but I suspect that we do. Mm-hmm. Broadway audiences expect to be taken on a journey and then brought back home.
A button.
Yes, a button. Some very sophisticated buttons, but buttons nonetheless. So it took me a while, and I had to have more confidence in the modern dance field. I had proven with the assistance of my deceased partner, Arnie Zane, that we could make something from nothing, that sandlot gymnastics could, if crafted in the correct way, talk about partnering that is ever just as essential to human experience as the white swan potted during the second act of Swan Lake. Now, is it as elegant? Does it appeal to the same taste? Not necessarily, but there is human interaction. You need timing. You need a sense of partnership in that kind of roughhouse partnering that he and I were doing. And then we thought, how do you expand that language that he, 5'4", Jewish-Italian man, and me, a 6'1", African-American man, we had found something that the world had not seen before. We thought we wanted a company. So once you want a company, the economics, everything changes in the art world. Now, we didn't have investors. We didn't have producers. We had to have just our smarts and hopefully the largesse of individuals and corporations to say, yes, make your next work. We were always in debt, always holding out our fingernails, but we thought that was the noble art form. So I made my name there. I am Bill T. Jones, I am the founding director of New York Live Arts. That was a big risk to leave the identity of a single choreographer concert dance company and move into being, in a way, a kind of administrator and still trying to do the work. I was fortunate around the time of that merger to be offered a number of things. You mentioned the Seven. There was Spring Awakening, when Tom Hulsey touched or pushed my literary buttons, reminding me of the controversy around Vadigan's great play, and he talked about young people, and at that time it was MySpace. That was the thing. And when I met the wonderful Michael Mayer, he was saying, he showed me a kid on YouTube, MySpace,
yeah.
a guy, skinny kid, looks like from an indie movie, with a brush in his bedroom wearing boxer shorts, singing his heart out and moving. He said, when they it's going to be set in the 1890s, but when they speak their heart, it should feel like this kid in his boxer shorts speaking his truth. And when he expressed that to me, that kind of, oh, I mean, you can do that. You can switch channels on the Broadway stage. And it's at the service of deep emotions, and playwriting is its secret weapon. All those things seemed very much like a green light to me. Mm-hmm. Go there. Mm-hmm. And there's a chance that it would be a bigger, more diverse audience than you're accustomed to having. Mm-hmm. I do remember we had conversations about why there weren't more black people. And at that point, we're talking now soon to be 10 years ago, maybe more. He said some things which I wonder if he still believes. He said, well, first of all, you realize that that musical theater is not cool for black kids. And I thought, is that true? Well, you know, I don't know. I was, like I say, I've been over here in the, quote, art world, right, which has its own problems around, right, race. But we also had Mr. Ailey and you and other people who were conservatory trained who were people of color. Mm-hmm. But Spring Awakening gave me an, I could recall those rock and roll genes of mine. I had been at Woodstock at age 17. I knew what headbanger music was. I knew what it meant to rebel through the music. And with the help of Duncan Sheik, we made room for that kind of stomping chaos. And that was when I earned my first Tony Award. Around that time, a wonderful man, his name was Steve Hindell, who was in fact an oil trader, who loved certain music of, what do you call it, world music, mm-hmm, and particularly the music of Africa, and he loved Fela. Mm-hmm. And he said that his wife was a wonderful investor in a number of Broadway shows and all, and he had done some, but he said, this is the greatest music that no one's ever heard of. Now, no one, of course, being the Broadway community, because most of us radicals, who fancied ourselves radicals back in the 70s, Fela would be, the poster would be there next to Bob Marley, next to Che Guevara. So Fela's music was the music of protest and all, but he was saying, this is something the Broadway audience wants to see and needs to see. So he offered me an option to do what you want to do. Easier said than done. Okay. With Jim Lewis, who I had met when he was a dramaturg at the Guthrie Theater, and he and I had been talking about finding a project that might have a populist appeal, that maybe we should be looking at, and he showed me a bunch of things, but then this one, he said, this should be hallucinatory. This wild man who is smoking pot on stage should be able to talk about politics and sex and all of those things. And I was in. We wrote this thing. It took us 2 years to clear the rights because Fela's publishers on different coasts, his children. It's no plaything to be the children of Fela in a country that literally, in some ways, tried to break him, dictator after dictator. And they were trying to keep that feeling of rebellion alive. And when I met his youngest son, Seyoun, I was performing in Central Park, and he was brought to, no, was he performing or was I performing? I don't remember. But he said, I told him about the Broadway show. He said, oh, Broadway? I don't even own a tuxedo. So in his mind, Broadway and the ballet or opera were the same thing. So that's it took us a while to get their trust and that we could do justice to their very controversial father. And that changed my life in a way. It gave me carte blanche to come into the Broadway world. No, there were things I did not know. I thought you don't need a book. I thought that this form was just waiting for somebody to come in and reinvent it. So it worked to a certain degree, but much to our chagrin, it couldn't stay alive in the climate that wants. Well, what did it want? It wants stronger narratives. I had people telling me, actually a young man, a gay publicist, sweet man, who said, well, you know, my friends don't know if they should come or not because they don't know what it is. Is it an African dance concert? Which means they wouldn't go to an African dance concert. They want a musical. Right. They didn't know this was a musical. They weren't sure if it was okay for them. Mm. So I learned a lot from that. Yeah. And now I'm being interviewed today as a choreographer who works in different media and different forms. Mm-hmm. And it's true, I have been artist in residence at the Lyon Opera Ballet. Mm-hmm. So I have worked in opera ballet company. I have done opera, and still my family, my home is Beltie Jones Arnie Zane Company, which is trying to take some of the lessons I've learned from places like Broadway, like Michael Mayer, about storytelling and about what it means to have a momentum and in an arc to what we do. Mm-hmm. I've learned some of those things and I bring it back to my work. By the same token, I'm looking constantly for the right project in on Broadway, or once again, the commercial theater, a project that I think can do a number of things. One of which, can it really communicate the level of my questions, I'm going to say my anxiety, around being alive in the 21st century? Mm-hmm. We know that the racial question has not gone away. So how do you make an entertainment in which, in a room which is, well, most of the creative teams are not black people? It's true. So you're going to come into that, and you're going to come in as whom? Are you no longer black? Are you now a person that is a good liberal, and you understand the history of this form, and you can speak that language? I laughed on the way into your office today when I saw Agnes DeMille on the wall. And I'm saying, oh, I'm in the same club as Aggie? You know, I don't think she would think so. But it was, I'm being asked, can it do that? Can it speak to the real questions, existential and others, that drive me as a modern person? That's one. Does it have the potential to find a broad, diverse audience? That's a big one. And the third is, can I actually find a project that's actually going to be a hit so that it can pay?
Mm-hmm. Something
and have a life. Yeah. Something you don't expect in the art dance world. All those things come to every project. Mm-hmm. One of your questions, as I understand, how do I change from piece to piece? I think everything I do in my training as an artist, and an artist that interrogates form, there's a set of questions, and the questions change from piece to piece. So one is I am trying to answer my questions, and at the same time, what does the production need? Mm-hmm. The director, what does he think the audience needs? What is the story?
Right.
On many occasions, I've run into situations where someone will be watching an early version of my work on a show, not necessarily as director, but maybe as choreographer, and they'll say, well, it's so interesting, but like, what's it got to do with the storyline? And I think, oh, dance doesn't need to explain itself. It's just, look at the way it's moving in space, and look at it is its own thing. They appreciate it, they being oftentimes producers or collaborators, but they say, but you're not doing dance the theater that Broadway wants. Mm-hmm. You're trying to do concert dance. That's a tension.
Yeah.
I still have that tension. I would love to lead a project or be part of a project that can understand how abstraction can soar, and that everyone in the room is telling their own story from mm-hmm. what we're doing on stage. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be what the commercial theater wants. We want to commune around a storyline.
Right.
That's something I push up against. I understand the value of it, because mm-hmm. I love contemporary television. I'm a big fan of this era of series writing. Mm-hmm. I think it's a golden age.
Mm-hmm.
Long narrative arcs,
yes.
Sometimes very obvious in the way that you can, when you're watching, you see a team of writers sitting around. Well, if she does this in the first act, she should be doing this, and she should do this, and then this should happen, or maybe we should, you know, you can feel the machinations mm-hmm. of the writing process. Whereas in the dance world that I call my home, you don't necessarily have that. You have, okay. It's like moving, it's something sculptural or more mm-hmm. freely musical. And every project that I approach in the commercial theater, I think, how much of that attitude can work in this piece? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you find, I guess, what would be the difference to approaching actors as opposed to singers, as opposed to dancers in musical theater, and then dancers in the concert world?
Mm.
Sort of a broad question. I'm just curious what you've sort of come up against and how it's shifted, or is it sort of the same kind of question?
Yes, it's always question, isn't it? Who and what are the materials you're working with? In my company, I say grandly that the performers are sublime materials. That means they have the bodies. They're Miss Martha Graham's notion of the acrobats of God. It's true, but they also have hearts and souls, and the other stuff is going on that you have to take into consideration. Now, that's certainly true in all of the other forms you mentioned. It was a shock to me when I did some of my first works outside of the world of concert dance, and I realized the book or the narrative is supreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. This goes first. Unless this information is brought in at this point in the show, mm-hmm. then you have failed. No matter how interesting it has got to be serving that book.
Right.
And other things. I remember working at the Houston Grand Opera. I was choreographing Sir Michael Tippett's New Year, as directed by Sir Peter Hall, and the anxiety that the singers had around costumes.
Oh, sure.
Oh, literally. And
yeah.
And what could they and could not do? Because someone said, you have to realize that they're very anxious. They have this little flap of skin in their throat is their whole identity. So they sometimes take anxiety about that, and I don't mean to be pejorative, you know, or condescending. They take the anxiety around that little flap of skin, their voice, and they project it onto the costumes, the set, all of these things. Why are you having me move my arms like this when I'm trying to hit that note and so on? So the different performers have different anxieties.
Mm-hmm.
I was working once, making a ballet with a beautiful dancer. Jennifer Gelfand was her name, mm-hmm. a dancer. You know her,
I
right?
I went to school in Boston.
Did you really
yeah,
know
I
her?
She was I, a did. She, I met her a few times.
She was a delight, wasn't she?
Yes.
And I remember she was working with Arthur Aviles, who was a mm-hmm. star in my company, very earthy, very beautiful dancer. And they were dancing Goldberg variations.
Mm-hmm.
And I had her sitting on her knees. And she said, you realize you never ask a ballerina to sit on her knees. And I thought, oh, interesting. That's, quote, a neutral position, you know?
Yes.
But it wasn't neutral. So I had to have respect for her in that regard. Same thing when I worked with the Axis Dance Company.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, it's a mixed ability company,
right.
where many of the performers are in wheelchairs, but not all of them. And there were certain things that you did and didn't. You did not put somebody in another person's chair, even if people were willing to get off the chair. But you have to think it's really disrespectful, and it's a transgression to actually have someone, particularly a fully abled person sitting in the chair. But I thought, the chair is just a thing, just a prop. But they schooled me on that one.
Right.
You know? So yeah, they're all different.
Yeah.
Now what does stay the same? For me, what stays the same is, what is the question going into this project, into this particular one?
Mm-hmm.
What is the music asking? Or is there no music? What is there about this character that we think that we know from what the text is telling us, but how can that be subverted or somehow or other by something I might ask them to do or not do?
Right.
That's how I work in different situations.
Wonderful. I'm curious if there, you sort of spoke about this a little bit too, but has there been projects that have been surprisingly satisfying that you didn't expect it?
First of all, I have to realize you're speaking to a crazy man who
sure, that's why you're here.
Thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. Who I have had to confess. Someone asked me, well, what has never changed in your career? And I say, doubt. It burns like fire. There's always doubt.
Of course.
So you're asking me if there's something that has surprised me about how successful it was. I think Spring Awakening. when Michael Mayer said, "No, Bill, this is going to be your number." And I said, "I don't do numbers." I don't do numbers. I make atmosphere, situations. But you know what? He was right. And he really made me look good. Mm-hmm. He said, "Here, you want to do this, this, and this." And okay, I wanted to have them all the young performers who swore they were not triple threats. They were like a badge of honor that they did not dance. We sing. Yes. I find out some of these guys who had said that, when I knew them for a while, "Oh, you were in a high school hip-hop company? What do you call that?" "Oh, well, you know," and it wasn't their real job. But I was trying to get them to all do something, a set of gestures. Mm-hmm.
I remember that.
Fast.
Yes.
And one day they were so off that it sort of was being interesting. Mm-hmm. And Catherine Gabin, a gorgeous Graham trained dancer, was working with me. She was there. And I asked Catherine, "Just do this as fast as you can." And this gorgeous woman with blonde hair, she starts doing these gestures, and suddenly blah, 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 or became another thing. And Michael said, "Oh, that's great. They shouldn't be in unison, you know." So that was something I thought, oh, so that kind of chaos, that kind of accident actually had a breakthrough in that moment. So it does happen.
Yeah.
It does happen.
Yeah, I remember that gesture sequence, and I was like,
yes.
There's Bill. There he is.
Or do you remember the scene where all the boys are in the classroom in the beginning, and that's what totally fucked. Mm-hmm. I think it's the one. And then at one point, I could hear it, and Duncan, we were all sitting there, and I said, "Well, stomp." And the guys started really stomping. Mm-hmm. And everyone said, no, it's going to be too loud. We won't be able to mic them. And Duncan said, "No, man, it's cool. Let's go for it." Duncan said it was okay. So suddenly it became a mark of it. These were rambunctious young boys, even though they were supposed to be in 1898 or something. Right. They suddenly were behaving like young punksters. Right. And in present day.
Yeah.
Wonderful discovery.
Yeah, those are, I tend to find that I walk in and, "Oh, I'm not a dancer. I'm not a dancer."
Yeah, but.
Like, "Do you fall down a lot?" Like, no, I'm like, "Then you're fine."
Fantastic.
"Then you're fine."
"Then you're fine."
Yeah. And yeah. Did you find you have to sort of, I find sort of like a dial with different actors within a piece?
A dial, you say?
Just sort of finding like, oh, this is as far as you can go here.
Oh, yeah.
This is for here and here and here and, you know, in moving into, we'll say specifically theater, I touched on this a little bit. Was that a surprise to you, of having to adjust when you have your dancers for these sublime, amazing things? You can kind of throw everything at them.
Even then, I could do better at really being able to read. I think what you're asking, the true contours of a person's nature.
Mm-hmm.
Do we dare say the limits of their elasticity?
Sure.
We could say that.
It's way better said than I.
Yes. Say. Well, do you know what I'm talking about? Because if someone says, "Well, they're a limited actor," or something, that's so unfair.
Mm-hmm.
What it means is they're not suited to this.
Right.
It took me a while to realize that.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And I've made mistakes. I've made mistakes as a result, because I was on the impression that give a person something that's a little too hard, and over time they will rise to it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are beat down by it. And it adds a level of anxiety and tension that maybe didn't have to be there. You know, it was funny. I was, when around the time of Spring Awakening, I was having one of those luncheons with, you know, what they call the Tony luncheons or whatever.
Sure, sure.
And I said to Tommy Toon, lovely man, mm-hmm. I said to him, "Well, tell me, you know, how do you keep it fresh?" He said, "Look, go in and change things." Now, Tommy, did you mean what you said to me? Or maybe I don't have your finesse, because
right. They're
so anxious already. And then you're going to say, "Oh, you know, by the way, I think these four beats, we should change from this, 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 to this, this, this." And some people, that's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have taken them a while to get that into their bodies.
Right.
So, yeah, go in and change things. Keep them off guard. Keep them off balance a little bit, you know.
They're kind of already off balance.
Yeah, let's put it this way. I've had mixed results with that.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always find that interesting, that the materials that you're given to work with,
mm-hmm.
to downplay that they're people, but you know, as you're moving through these different disciplines, mm-hmm. it's so fascinating how it shifts your thought process, but also stays the same, that deep questioning. Mm-hmm. You know, that's your sort of root, which is incredible.
I mean, that's who they are, the people are?
That's how you approach it.
Yes, yeah.
You know, how I always find it fascinating that mine has stayed the same, too. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of vacillates around what we have, and then you kind of delve in, and you, like you said, you discover new things, which I think is...
And the whole idea of understudies is a science, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
And swings.
Do you know we crafted this around this person's ability to do this movement?
Yes.
And now you have someone who is a lovely performer, but they've got to like mimic that because that's what you've built into the choreography. Mm-hmm. You know, so it is. I'm still trying to work that one out. Another thing is partnering. You know, I come from the... I wouldn't say we were crash and burn school of choreography. You know what I'm talking about. If you look at the Germans or Billy Forsythe, people like that, like, you know, how many ways can you go in and out of the floor or toss them around? 8 shows a week, Bill? Seriously? It's so exciting. And opening night, it looked fantastic. But week 6, you know,
when
a little tired, the injuries and so on.
Right.
And you think, oh, this is such an unnatural form for a creative choreographer because you've got to always be playing with diminished expectations.
Yeah.
No, I don't know if that's true. I believe you just have to be more smart in your choices, maybe. And that's what's exciting right now about, as I move into this field more, what I'm learning about that. Because I use this term, it's so, and I think it's unkind. I said, I don't want to become a hack. And what does that mean? When you see the work of someone who has been successful, they have a formula, and they know it works, and after a while, it looks, there's no surprise.
Right.
Now, where do you get this idea that it's supposed to be a surprise? Are you still back in the avant-garde where you thought that everything had to be original and reinvented? Or are you saying that the audience, if you're watching Shakespeare, you've seen Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet 500 times, you want to see or hear a new take on those words. We don't have the words, you know, unless you're doing a revamp of something like a Jerome Robbins piece in West Side Story or Agnes DeMille or what have you. But most of us are trying to make it up every time.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make it up every time that satisfies your need for some freshness? And how do you... understand that it has to be able to be repeatable and it has to still be able to deliver surprise.
Mm-hmm.
That's very challenging in any art form.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think finding out that they have to do it 8 times a week that wasn't even a leap. I didn't even think about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, from coming from the concert world where
they
are used to doing it, but there's also sometimes like a double cast,
which
I believe they did in Moving Out with Twyla Tharp.
Oh, it would have to with Twyla.
Absolutely.
I think they would have to.
Which I thought was very smart. And I think Matthew Bourne also does that with his work when he brings it to the theater, which I think is a very smart, you know, translation between the two.
Another area that I'd like to talk about is there's something about when you're working on a new show and you're the choreographer, and they say, we want you to do what you do, we want you to find these interesting performers, but then people you choose, you hear later, oh, we didn't take them because they can't sing. Well, wait a minute. I thought you wanted, we just want this guy. It's fantastic what they can do. And yeah, but you know, we only have so many places and they got to sing in the chorus. They got to be able to, they don't have good pitch. And so I have had to understand and make an adjustment that maybe it isn't only about what I find the ultimate in excitement, but that the, I guess what you hear here is the complaint, where am I in the pecking order?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Acting, singing come first, I think.
Yes.
You know?
I do.
Then we want you to have some exciting dancing. Well,
okay. I'll do what I can.
I'll do what I can,
yes.
And you hope for a triple threat. But I was shocked. That was when I know how you feel. I was shocked when I started working in this field that triple threats are still rather difficult to find.
Yeah.
Rare.
Yeah.
Rare.
I guess that's also my question, too, then, is, you know, when you shift, like, in the modern and, let's say, ballet world, the concert dance world, where both you and I come from, choreographer, we all call it the choreographers, the director, But in a sense, you're also the writer and the director.
Yes, the auteur.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And costume line design sometimes when you're starting out. which mine were always terrible. So, and then you find yourself into the theater world where there is then that different sort of priorities to what serves the story first.
Yes.
What's the top? How does that go down?
And that goes back to, you realize I came into the art world at a time when it was into the performing world, it was anti-narrative, anti-stories. Yeah. It was, like I say, about space, time, architecture, all those things. Mm-hmm. And then you're in a form that is decidedly a storytelling form.
Yeah.
You got to get your mind around that.
Right.
And whose story is it?
Right.
Maybe it's not your story. You've got to bring your sensibility to telling someone else's story. That's been a hard one to learn for me. You got to believe in the stories, and I'm not sure. In opera, everyone sort of like raises an eyebrow and said, we all know opera librettos and don't make a lot of sense. We don't expect them to. At least that's the 19th century version. And I think now probably operas are being written with more of attention to naturalism, more attention to psychological believability, what have you. But the great operas, they just need charismatic performers and those voices.
Those voices, exactly.
Now, what are we doing on Broadway? Sometimes I feel that it's not very great material, but you just need to be blessed with a star or someone, a star in the making. Isn't that what we want on stage? Something happened. This person did, saying Mary had a little lamb in a way that sent chills down my spine.
Sure.
You know, we hope for that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's a whole other art form then that just captures you, that magic.
It is storytelling. It's one of the aspects of popular storytelling,
right.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Sometimes difficult to separate it from who is speaking it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I've seen ballets where the dancer does not have to be great, but somehow the movement, the combination of steps, the spatial arrangements is the star.
Right.
Just serve that. Yeah.
Hopefully you get that all to come together.
All come together, and 8 times a week.
On the top of it, yes. Well, I think that's about the time we have.
Oh, wonderful.
Bill, thank you so much. It was such,
such a pleasure. It's good
this
to talk to
great.
You. Easy to talk as well.
Thank you. I just every week.
Yeah, right. But,
thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by SDCF, Stage Directors and Choreographers Foundation. SDCF acknowledges and extends a very special thanks to its 2018-2019 leading contributors, the David Lee Foundation, the Hargrove Pierce Foundation, the Oki Foundation, Trip Coleman, Sheldon Epps, Linda Hartzell, Doug Hughes, and Thomas Kale for their support this season. SDCF events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of career. To find out more, visit our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.